where it's got foothills to it, so to speak. It starts getting broader. Put in two signals, and you'll see this broadening phenomenon. You're getting signal cross signal and signal cross noise terms, which, if you happen to be listening to a weak signal at the frequency region of the foothill of that single sine wave that I described, it could be covering up your signal. So there are situations in which you're listening to a weak signal in the noise. You're not in an intermod area at all. However, because your amplifier is getting a subtle amount of limiting from the noise, and this particularly happens with moonbound skies. The moonbound skies want to make sure that they've got the lowest possible noise figure of the front amplifier. They want to make sure they're overloading the noise of the receiver. They tend to put 20, 30, and 40 decibels of preamplification gain between the antenna and the receiver. In some cases, they're getting S9 of just background noise on the receiver before any signal is received. At first, that sounds good, because you think the receiver can go all the way up to plus 60 in signal strength before, you know, S9 plus 60, so to speak, on the signal strength meter before it goes into nonlinearity. Well, when you're putting in a single sine wave, that's true. When you're putting in broadband noise, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, maybe anything more than S3 on the S meter is dangerous. You can find this out real fast by doing a sun noise measurement. There are guys who have basic noise in the receiver because they got so much preamplification where they get S9 on the receiver before a signal comes along. They want to measure the sensitivity of the receiver for moonbound operation, and they wave the antenna across the sun. A real good moonbound setup, you wave the antenna across the sun, you'll see 5, 6, 10 dB of sun noise increase. You're really building a kind of a radio telescope. And then, in some cases, if they're smart enough, they'll plug in 10 dB somewhere along that preamplifier chain of amplifiers. So instead of getting S9 on the S meter, they're getting S7.5, so to speak. And they do the sun noise measurement again, and where they used to measure 5 dB of sun noise, they now measure 6 dB of sun noise. The receiver appears to be more sensitive. And of course, at first that sounds crazy. I put nothing but pure attenuation between an amplifier and the antenna, and all of a sudden, somewhere in the amplifier chain, choose the right spot, by the way, and all of a sudden the receiver is more sensitive, even though I've put in pure attenuation. What was happening is that the noise is so potent that the crest factor was so high that some one of the stages in the receiver was occasionally going into limiting, and it was mixing together just like third order and fifth order intermodulation products with sine wave. It was mixing noise with noise and making other noise components. Very subtle, very hard to see. You won't see it on a spectrum analyzer. You do a sun noise measurement, and boy, it's there. So you're into an extremely subtle area. Not very many of the ham moon bouncers understand this one. When it comes to making a receiver that has maximum sensitivity and maximum linearity at the same time, that's an extremely difficult combination. Maximum linearity comes when you use minimum gain. Maximum sensitivity happens when you use nearly maximum gain. There's a conflict of interest there. I know this won't make complete sense the first time you hear it, but maybe a little bit of it is starting to make some sense, Frank. K2MLB. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, fine, Dick. K2RIW, K2MLB returning. Well, that was just terrific. I can't tell you how helpful it was and what a lucid explanation of effectively what atmospheric noise and all that random noise, so-called, does in terms of, as you explained it, a multiplicity of sine waves and how it affects the linearity amplifier. Well, guess what? So the guys that do this are right in doing it, Dick, but I guarantee they don't know what you just told me. So that's really cleared up an excellent point for me on the atmospheric noise, and thank you very much.
Yeah, you can tell that this kind of a problem exists, particularly in a very crowded country like Japan. If you and I were a ham radio operator in downtown Tokyo, you would have to live with the fact that there's another ham radio operator every block when you go down the street, so to speak. And as such, many of the rice boxes you and I buy are terribly gain-starved. In other words, they start off with a 12 dB noise figure on 432 and 2 meters and 6 meters. And the first thing you and I do is we go out to advanced receiver research and we plug in a gas-fed 20 dB gain, 1 dB noise figure amplifier in the front end and pick up 13 dB of more sensitivity. And the first thing you'll ask yourself is, gee, why do we have to keep doing that with all of these beautiful Southeast Asia pieces of equipment we buy? And when it comes to transmitter linearity, when it comes to receiver selectivity, when it comes to receiver stability, when it comes to most of the parameters of the receiver, these synthesized rigs we buy are damn good pieces of equipment. But when it comes to maximum sensitivity, they fail miserably. And the reason they fail miserably is that Japan leaves out that preamplifier because overload characteristics of all those zillions of hands in Tokyo, so to speak, is a more prevalent problem than sensitivity. The ham in Tokyo has to have a system that can tolerate strong signals. That's more important to him than ultimate sensitivity. You and I buy that rig, and maybe we live in Podunk, Iowa, where we're the only ham for the nearest 50 miles, and in that case, maximum sensitivity counts. Overload characteristics don't. So you and I add the preamp, we add the sensitivity back, but then you move that receiver into New York City, and all of a sudden you get overload and get some funny characteristics. So depending on the busyness of the band during that particular day, when you buy that advanced receiver research preamp, the external one that's got the relay in it, you notice that it's got an on-off switch. And there are times when you flip the switch into the off mode, which bypasses the preamplifier, because the preamplifier on that particular day when the band is busy is hurting you more than it's helping. So there's a lot more to this than first meets the eye. But this noise cross noise term, a noise cross signal term, crowding, overloading the receiver in such a way that it desensitizes certain frequency regions, and therefore the weak signal you want to listen to is covered up by the intermod noise made in your receiver by noise cross noise and signal cross noise terms. So there are times when you want to listen to a weak signal, and I've had this happen many times during 432 meg contests, where I plug in 10 or 20 dB of attenuation on the front end of my receiver, and the weak signal I'm listening to improves in signal to noise ratio. The first time you see it, you'll scratch your head and say, what in the world is going on? Those guys that you talk about, they're working on experience. They know from their experience, from their experimentation, what works, even though we have a little bit of difficulty explaining why it works. Pass it back to you, Frank, for any other comments. K2MLB, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, fine, Dick, K2MLB returning. Well, you hit the nail exactly on the head also. I live on a hill here at 600 feet. It actually overlooks New York City, and there's a lot of stuff up here within a mile or so of me. When I say stuff, I mean repeaters, a commercial FM station, all kinds of microwaves, and throughout the years, especially years ago when there were so, you know, prior to cell phones, when there were so many services in the special industrial band operating on the high band, and then the low band was just below 6 meters. My biggest problem was overload, and so I've been fighting that problem for years when I was more active on VHF. And incidentally, I meant to comment when you talked about the 221. I have kind of the updated version of that, the FT225, which was a 2 meter rig, and the 625, which was the 6 meter version. They were such nice radios, Dick, that I still kept them. I haven't gotten rid of them, even though they're so old, they're still in the basement. So that's fine, and I see it's 9. I'm going to save a follow-up question to this to the next time that I'm privileged to join you, and I wonder if you get on next week with the contest or not.
I'm not sure whether or not I'll be operating in the contest next week. Probably not. I've been inactive these days. My consulting business is so darn busy that I don't do as much ham radio as I wanted to. What's crazy is I now work harder than I retired. I got to do something about that. Maybe I ought to just say, tell everybody I'm not available next weekend and enter the contest. I'm going to give that some thought. And by the way, if you got another question, I think you may be the last questioner tonight. Mel usually is very brief. He's going to tell us a little bit about Smith charts. That'll take him about a minute or two. And after that, we can get back to more questions. That was a joke. And by the way, you guys, if you get, I just got the February issue of QST Magazine. And if you turn to page 70 and 71, the section on hints and kinks, you'll see a beautiful color picture of a nice, great big Smith chart. And they're using the Smith chart to figure out where they should put stubs, short-circuited and open-circuited stubs of coax cable in the feed line in order to correct the reservoir for a particular antenna. Very nice article. I don't know if Mill has gotten his issue yet, but I guarantee he'll have a big smile on his face when he sees this one. Before I turn it over to Mill for that exact subject, let's make sure I haven't missed anybody who signed in and said they had a question. And I think Barry was one who maybe had it. KC2MLJ, if you're there, and the group, K2RIW and the TechNet.
And WS2N is here. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, WS2N, we'll be hearing a nice space report from Paul. And by the way, for those who are astronomically enthusiastic, the McNulty or McNulty, I can't think of the name of the darn comet right now, the brightest comet since 1965 is in our sky right now. That's the good news. The brightest comet since 1965. That makes 41 years of history, and this thing is topping that, so to speak. That's the good news. The bad news is the comet is only 6 degrees away from the sun. The comet is so bright, you can see it at high noon if you know where to look. One fist width at arm's length to the left of the sun at high noon, you will see this comet. Make sure you're in the shadow of a building or do something else so you're not directly looking at the sun when you do this. And so it's a very bright comet. As the comet moves away from perihelion, which is essentially at right now, the closest point, and it's getting brighter and brighter, it's going to move to our south so that the people in the southern hemisphere are going to get a beautiful view of this comet at nighttime. But it's going to move out of the places where we can see it. So that's something interesting. Now, Mel, I wonder if you've seen your February issue, and probably you would like to go with lesson number 7, I think it is, on Smith chart and how to earn $1 million by having a ham radio license with Smith chart license at the same time. K2KEY, K2IW, the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. No, I did not get the February issue yet. I noticed somebody in the post office, I'm sure that's either interested in ham radio or maybe the ham radio operator, but doesn't subscribe to QST. Because I always get it late. I guess after he read it, then he puts it into my mailbox. Let's see. First thing I was going to say, make a comment about, you know, low frequencies, 80, 160, and all my favorite bands. I have learned, like old timers really clued me into, that most of them ride the RF gain. What I mean by that is that they just put the RF gain up high enough on the receiver to hear the station. This helps to contribute quite a bit to a lot of reduction in all kinds of extraneous noises, Dick. Let me make that statement first, and then we'll talk about some other things. Over.
Well, that's a beauty. I remember before I had a good receiver with a real product detector made for single sideband reception, what we all used to do is to put the receiver in the CW mode where the beat frequency oscillator was operational, and you could then tune across your sideband signal, and you could sort of hear the audio, but it was heavily distorted. Until you turned the RF gain real low, where the receiver started acting in a linear manner when you're in the CW mode, and you do a combination of correct tuning of the BFO knob that we used to have and the receiver, and out came clean sideband. So it's a reconfirmation that when you lower the gain by putting in padding or expanding the automatic gain control voltage or whatever, when you lower the gain of a receiver, as long as it has the right threshold, without a doubt, its linearity always improves, and in many cases, that makes life a lot nicer. Back to you, Mel.
Very good. This is K2KEY. Yeah, I've
fact, that's why I like to use on 75 meters, I use the cone 75A4 receiver. First of all, the mechanical filter, the use of a mechanical filter for some reason smoothens things out as far as noise and other extraneous conditions. Whereas with the receivers, the more modern solid-state receivers, they seem to be maybe a little bit more sensitive to it, or whatever it is, that they do not have the same, maybe I don't know how to describe it, you actually have to hear it. But basically, if I ride the RF gain up and down on the Collins 7584 receiver, get the passband tuning set correctly, and get the rejection tuning set, use the mechanical filter, it makes life somewhat better. However, that's what I'm going to get to. Did you get a chance, first of all, to look at that receiving antenna that's in the 19th issue of the ARRL antenna book, Dick, over?
Negatory. I didn't do my homework assignment, teacher. Sorry about that. And my ARRL antenna book is still in the salt mine, and I was in a bunch of meetings. I got at the door gate my homework, but sorry to say I didn't do it. Go ahead.
Okay, well, this is another point that I was going to bring out. In order to operate 75 meters, I was on, in fact, with Paul one night. The noise level has been going between, at the best, S8, at its worst, 15 over 9. That's on the normal, you would think on my loop antenna out there, the one wavelength loop, you know, I'd have some kind of a bliss there with operating on 80 meters, 75 meters. So it's been a rough situation. So any signal that comes in the last week or so, arrives anywhere from under S8, forget about it. I would never be able to copy them. During the holidays, with everything else that was going on, anybody that was under 5 over 9 was also lost. However, with the receiving loop that I built, this is that one that they have in the antenna book, it is approximately, approximately 12 foot of wire stretched around this loop. So the loop is about 6 feet in diameter or so. And the loop works real well. It gives you a nice null peak to signal, change the angle, and you'd be amazed how many times the signal. I know they're transmitting, they'll tell me on dipoles and all, but many times how I receive the signal better with the loop in its vertical position. But the size of the loop inside the Radio Shack is a lot to be desired. It makes it so that you can't get around my Radio Shack. This thing sits on, I have it sitting on a camera, a regular camera mount, so that I can, you know, turn it and tilt it and do all the goodies with it. So I was thinking, I started to think, can I make this thing smaller, half the size, and make it instead 6 feet in circumference rather than 12 feet in circumference, Dick. And this is what I wanted to get to. I wanted to run some ideas past the net, see if you or anybody else can maybe give me some input on some ideas that I have. A little bit of a radical different design in this situation. Basically, the loop that I'm using right now was made of a piece of RG-59 coax. It stretched around this wooden frame that actually it's a square wooden frame that I built. And the coax is stretched around the edge at the top of the, when it's mounted in a diamond, a vertical fashion with the one corner pointed upward. The coax shield is split 1 inch at that point. And then it's a variable condenser down on the bottom. And that's basically what the loop looks like, Dick. I don't know if you of receiving loop over.
I think too, Bravo Delta, John with information. Bravo Delta, John with information. We'll get to you in a second. One quick question. The variable capacitor at the bottom, is it, in your opinion, resonating the loop, Mel?
Most definitely, because adjusting that variable capacitor, you'll go from nothing of a signal to repeating the signal. And that's another thing I want to get to about the variable capacitor. I had to use a small value variable capacitor because my distributed capacitance on the loop wound up at 262 picofarads. So my distributed capacitance being 262 meant that my lump capacitance had to be much smaller. I want to get to that in a minute. And it's so that when I do, I twist the loop around. Once I set the variable, you know, if I change frequencies appreciably, I got to readjust the variable to repeat the signal. And I can also tilt the loop somewhat to also bring the signal in. But I can null noise. I can get a nice spot where I get a happy medium where I get minimum noise to signal ratio. This is basically what makes the difference. In fact, the other night when I was talking to Paul, the noise level, as I said, was about 5 over 9 or so. Paul was coming in on the receiving loop at about S8, but my noise level, with nulling the noise out and going through my also our QRN squasher, I was getting the noise, bringing the noise level down to S2. So that made it perfect copy on him, Dick, over.
Doesn't surprise me. And the desirable signal you want to listen to is coming from a certain range, and of all the possible ways that signal can bounce off the ionosphere, go as ground wave and whatever, there is some kind of a composite vector by which that signal comes to you. In other words, the strongest reception is at some particular azimuth and elevation of reception. And by you tilting the loop and rotating the loop, you're finding that magic position. Whereas the noise is coming from a zillion places around the world all at once, and it doesn't peak in the same direction. So by tilting and rotating, I can see how you maximize the signal-to-noise ratio, even though the signal itself may not be maximum. Yep, I can see that. And in many cases, on a noisy band like 80 meters, signal-to-noise ratio is more important than absolute signal amplitude. John, I know he wanted to add some things to this. I didn't hear his whole call, but I know it ends in Bravo Delta. Give us your full call, John, K2RIW on the TechNet.
This is the W2VL repeater.
Hey, good evening, Dick, and everyone on the net. K2RIW on the TechNet from Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. I've had some experience with loops. I haven't played with them much lately on HF, but I use them quite extensively on medium frequencies and low frequency spectrum. And I just wanted to relay to Mel that, yes, you can make the loop a multi-turn loop and save some space in the shack as long as you're still able to resonate the loop with the variable capacitor. I'm somewhat familiar with the design that Mel's using. I put something together like that many, many years ago to do some direction finding work in the upper HF spectrum. And basically, Mel's keeping the shield on that coaxial cable to shield the antenna because the antenna itself is essentially a balanced antenna that has a very high input impedance. And the way he's feeding it, he's just feeding one side of that loop. So he's actually putting an unbalanced transmission line on a balanced antenna. And the shield prevents, keeping the shield on the coax in the loop, helps prevent the loop itself from acting as, a receptor of E-field energy. The loops that I use on lower frequencies, I don't use shields at all. In fact, I kind of cheat a little bit on winding them, and I use ribbon cable, 10 conductor ribbon cable. I have an antenna that uses 40 conductor ribbon cable. I use that for WWVB reception at 60 kilohertz. The signal is buried in the noise, but with that antenna I can pull it out of the noise quite nicely. There's almost 700 feet of flyer in that antenna. And none of these antennas are, I have another one that I use on for broadcast AM reception, and another one that I use for 500 kilohertz and below. I've been using that lately to pick up some of these experimenters in the 500 kilohertz region lately. The way I get around with not shielding those antennas is that I feed them to amplifiers with differential input. If I can put together a preamplifier that has a high common mode rejection ratio, I can feed that antenna directly into that amplifier, and the common mode rejection of that amplifier provides that shielding. Of course, that resonance, the antenna has a very high input impedance. So these differential amplifiers that I use, the one I use on for medium frequency range, I use a pair of MPF-102 field effect transistors, and the 60 kHz loop I use an analog device's instrumentation amplifier, an 8620 at the front end. K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Yeah, let me ask you a couple of quick questions. You used a 40-wire ribbon cable. I am guessing you took the ribbon cable and you made it into one or maybe a couple more loops, but the ends of the wire, you crisscrossed them together in such a way that if you only had one loop of the ribbon wire, the way you connected the ends together made it 40 equivalent turns. Is that true, John?
Roger, roger. I offset the connections on the bottom of the loop. I have them offset by one, thus forming a 40-turn loop. And in the case of the 60 kHz antenna, and 10 or 20 turns for the other antennas. Over.
And I bet you discovered in that process that resonating the antenna, resonating your loop, no matter how many turns, is the primary factor that determines whether or not it works at all. That you have to hit resonance at the frequency of interest in order to get a reasonable reception. I wonder if that's what you also discovered, John. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, I've read some articles on this. There are some equations that can predict the amount of output voltage you will get from the loop if you know the field strength of the signal you're receiving. Or, as I've done the opposite, I've gone the opposite way around. I've measured the output voltage of the loop. Knowing the characteristics of the loop, I was able to figure out what the signal, that signal strength, the field strength of the signal in microvolts per meter is. You can have a resonant loop, you could have an unresonant loop. Of course, an unresonant loop, you're going to get much less output signal. The output voltage of a resonant loop is basically what you would get with an unresonant loop times the Q of the tuned circuit. There was something else I wanted to say about that. Oh, yes. The output voltage of the loop is basically determined on the Q, the number of turns, and the inside diameter of that coil. So if Mel is able to keep the diameter fairly large and put two turns, he'll probably get about the same signal strength as he's getting right now with one large turn. K2RAW on the TechNet from KD2BD.
Interesting. And when you said the same signal strength, you may be giving me signal strength in units of volts, not units of power. In other words, if I half the area of the antenna, in theory I'm going to get half the intercepted power. Although, like, wait a minute, I've got to be careful here. Once you've got a resonance structure, the effective area becomes very different than what the eye sees. In the case of an 80-meter dipole, the actual area of the wire, if you made it out of a 14-gauge wire, is casting a shadow on the ground of a couple of square inches. But it's got an effective area, radio area, of 8,500 square feet. And I think you get a similar phenomenon with loop antennas. In other words, once you resonate the loop, I suspect that the effective area of the loop is greater, even if it's only a one-turn loop. I suspect the effective area is slightly greater than the area you see on the inside of that loop. I wonder if you've ever seen a phenomenon like that, John. Go ahead.
Well, I have some equations that can predict the induced voltage into the loop. And let's see. Yeah, it's number of turns times area is the A is area of the loop in square meters, N is the number of turns of the loop. That multiplied by 2 pi times little e, which is the field strength in microvolts per meter. That whole thing divided by lambda gives you the induced voltage in the loop in microvolts. So I'll just repeat that. The induced voltage in microvolts is equal to 2 pi times little e, where little e is the field strength in microvolts per meter, times n, which is the number of turns in the loop, divided by wavelength, lambda. And there are some other subsequent equations that take into account Q. And looks like the output voltage of the loop would actually be the equation governed by the equation I just gave you times the Q. K2RW on the TechNet from KD2BD.
Yeah, loops of fans are really interesting devices. And next time you're doing one of these real low-frequency receptions, do try to get a hold of Steve Barrera's K2CX, K2 Charlie X-ray. He also is fascinating by the, is it the Anderson, I can't think of the name of the device, the 60 kilohertz, I think it is, or is it a 17 kilohertz high-power transmitter they got over in Scandinavia, and they turn it on periodically. He gets great enjoyment out of setting up loop antennas to receive these. We'll come back to you in a second, John. Let me go back to Mel, because I think we're slowly discovering, Mel, that you have the ability, in your case, of lowering the diameter of the loop if you want, increasing the size of the capacitor so you reestablish resonance. Your microvolts per meter might decrease slightly, but as long as you've got enough signal-to-noise ratio into that receiver or enough receiver sensitivity, that could be a very good compromise, if I understand correctly. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Now this is K2KEY, I guess John and I are both fire on the same frequency, as they say. Basically, almost exactly what I was going to propose. Here's what I want to do. I want to, instead of, I could say, get rid of this fixing I got in the shack, cut it in half. And basically, how I came up with the idea, I was reading a number of little articles, little pieces here and there that I picked up on. And I started building it. In fact, I built the frame. I built the frame 18 inches, a square frame, 18 inches on a side, Dick. You got a piece of paper handy. Follow me, basically, so you visualize what I have proposed. I got this frame I built 18 inches on a square. Now, on the outside of this frame, I'm going to wind the main, or you may say the coil, the main receiving coil. And I figured I could take the same amount of wire that I used on the big one, and just wind two turns and connect the variable condenser across that. Now, what I'm going to do, something a little different. See, basically, this is how it's laid out now, and that go right to the receiver. However, I was thinking in the way of, I think John sort of alluded to it, using a Q multiplier. So what I propose to do now is wind another coil around the edge of this frame. This will be a second coil. This will go right to the receiver. And now I'm going to take a third coil that's going to be suspended in the middle on a rod inside this frame. If the frame is standing up on end, I put a piece of wood to form, looks like a triangle at the top if you look at it. You know, or if you look at it flat on the paper, it looks like you got a triangle on the top and a triangle on the bottom. You know, or a piece of corner molding on each side. And I got suspended between that. I've got a round dowel wood. And I'm going to put another loop in there. That's going to be a rotating loop. That's going to rotate independently of the main loop. And what I'm going to do with that, I'm going to put that in. Now, I figured I'm going to make up a little Q multiplier circuit using, basically, like John said, an FET. So you follow me basically, first of all, Dick, or did I lose you over?
I wonder if you're starting to build what used to be called a regen receiver. In other words, with the Fed amplifier on one of those coils, you're going to establish a very high Q of resonance. You're going to adjust it just shy of the point of oscillation. And then by tuning that coil in the middle, you're making what's called a goniometer, which is varying the coupling coefficient. So therefore, you can change the amount of loading of your Q-multiplied thing. It's beginning to sound like a kind of spatial amplifier you're building here. Mel, you got it, Mel.
Got it. Exactly. So now, with this third coil inside, this adjustable, I'll be able to exactly, like you say, adjust the regeneration. So I think that will improve the Q of the circuit. I would get, I'll have better control of separating noise and the desired signal because of the increase in Q. What do you think, Dick? Over.
I think that can fly. Making it stable is going to be a little bit tricky, making sure it doesn't kick into oscillation. But I think you can make that fly. In other words, whatever was the loss of your loop before because of the electronic gain you've added on at least one of those turns is going to be electronically, to some degree, subtracting that loss. It's going to become narrowband. I'm not convinced you'd be able to get an audio signal through this, but quite possibly you intend to listen to low frequency or medium frequency or ultra low frequency Morse code. I think that can work. Let's see what John thinks about this. KC2, here we go. KT2BD, K2RIW and the TechNet. You got it, John.
K2RIW and the TechNet from KD2BD. I have built a loop preamps with regeneration just to see what it would do. The end result, I didn't need to do that, but most certainly it increases the Q and the output level quite, and of course the selectivity as a result, quite dramatically. At that time, I was just using an oscilloscope as a receiver, and the regeneration really helped narrow the signal down to specifically what I was looking for. But I think if you go with a two-turn or maybe a three-turn loop, if you're going to use some amplification, some active electronics at the feed point, if you go with a differential input, you won't have to worry about the cable being shielded at all. And you won't have to worry about putting a secondary loop for coupling. You're going to have a very high input impedance with the FET input, so you can have your coil and your parallel capacitor go directly to the input of those two FETs with the sources connected together and some sort of a constant current source. I use usually a high value inductor, something like a 62 millihenry inductor as the constant current source for the sources. And take the output off one of the drains, and I think you'll get enough gain with just that, I don't know if you get that much gain, but I think the signal level will be strong enough that you won't need any regeneration at that point. K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Yeah, if I know Mel though, John, he's going to build both techniques, both the direct amplification and from a high impedance loop that's resonated, or the regenerated multi-turn, multi-coil goniometer type. If I know him, he's going to build both and compare the results. Am I close to guessing right? Mel, go ahead.
Yes, I did already. This is K2KEY. Well, what I did is experiment. I took a 312, ATG 312, or HEPHO 802. You know, it was a common FET. Garden variety one, and I made up a little circuit, and basically I'm taking the loop that I have now, and I'm feeding it directly into the gate of the FET through a 200 microfarad capacitor. I am now off the, I added a 2.5 millihenry choke between the one side of the loop that I have now and the source, and put a coupling capacitor there, 0.01, to the receiver, and to the drain, I just put in a 9 volts into the drain, and be amazed, it looks promising. So now, taking the same circuit, same idea, same input to the gate with the, will be be the main loop. I'm not going to use coax. I'm going to use just magnetic wire, a couple turns of it, until I get it resonant. I figure this way I can reduce my distributed capacitance down so that way I can increase my lump capacitance, my variable. In other words, I want to go the other way. Instead of high distributed capacitance, I want to go to a lower distributed capacitance so I can go to a higher variable, you know, a higher lump capacitance. Go into the gate of the 312VAO or the HEP802FET. On the source, I'm going to put this additional, the regeneration loop, this third one that I can turn inside in the source. And then, at the same time, I can say I'm going to try one experiment by using a separate coil, a separate turn in there on the edge. That's going to go to my receiver. That'll be to the coil that will be go directly to the receiver and leave this other two pieces so that I can experiment with the regeneration, Dick. See what happens when I increase the Q over.
Yeah, that could be fun. And I've used Q multipliers in the past. My very first receiver way back in the dark ages of 1956 was the Heathkit AR3, which tuned half meg to 30 megs inclusive in four bands. And when you bought the Q multiplier that you added to the IF strip, single signal reception for Morse code in the 80 and 40 meter band became a lot more pleasant. But it was a regenerative thing where you had to carefully adjust the control until it was just at the point, not quite oscillating, and also had a center frequency control. And it all worked at 455 KC. So you're building the equivalent. This loop, I think you're using it as either 1.8 megacycles or 3.5 or both. And so, although the concepts that you're using should also be usable down to 17 kilohertz and 60 kilohertz, so you can do some of the work that John has done and some of the work that Steve has worked with, K2 Charlie X-ray. Super low frequency reception uses some rather different characteristics, some rather different concepts. Let me ask you this one, John. I know for a while the guys who were doing AM receiver DXing, for a while you could buy this object that looked to me like it was about a foot in diameter, maybe a couple of inches thick, and it was a huge ferrite tunable thing that you put alongside of your AM portable transistor radio. You just put it near it, and I believe it was some kind of signal enhancer. I wonder if you can tell us, have you had any experience with that? Was that effective? Is it still manufactured? And so on. KD2BD, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW on the TechNet from KD2BD. I believe you're referring to a device called a select antenna, which is simply a loop resonated with a variable capacitor in the center, and you inductively couple it to your AM receiver by placing it close to the receiver. And since the loop's capture area is much greater than the internal ferrite loop, you get much enhanced, much better reception. I have a 10-turn loop that I use for AM reception. I use it in that very manner, just inductively coupling it to an AM receiver. And of course, at nighttime, it really doesn't matter very much. But during the day, I've heard KDK in Pittsburgh on ground waves. I've also heard a 500-watt station about 60 miles away with that little arrangement. And of course, with that loop, you hear nothing. So it adds a lot of signal. It adds some more directivity, which is kind of useful when you're trying to copy a station many states away that's 10 kilohertz away from one that's a lot closer than that. I've also, just as a lark, I put a crystal earphone and a 1N34 diode across this particular 10-turn loop, and I can pick up three stations with it as a crystal set. Two are 50 miles away from me. They are WSAN and WCBS, which are transmitting from the same tower. It's kind of a very unusual situation they have there, with two 50-kilowatt stations broadcasting from the same exact antenna tower on AM. That device is still made, and it basically is a loop, and you just resonate it with the variable capacitor on the front. I haven't done any of that really low frequency stuff. I am interested in seeing if I can copy that those experiments when they're done. I'm really fascinated by what I'm finding out on what I'm discovering on 60 kilohertz. I put together a complete frequency standard based on WWVB's transmissions, and I use that as a time base for a home-built frequency counter. And I've been participating in the ARRL frequency measurement tests. I've been just running some other off-air frequency measurements using a quadrature phasing receiver, direct conversion receiver, and I've been having a lot of fun with all that. I know for a while WOR on 710 kilohertz was running rubidium disciplined, or I should say GPS disciplined rubidium oscillator in their exciter. I don't know if that's still the case, but I did measure their frequency about a year ago, and it was right on the target. I measured it several months ago, and it seemed like it was close, but it also seemed like it was wandering a little bit, so I'm not sure if that's still the case. But if that is the case, then that's another local standard that can be used for frequency measurement purposes. K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Got two further questions for you, John. One, when you're using this select antenna device or the other loops that you use, do you set the loop, the plane of the loop, in the plane of the signal you want to listen to? In other words, when you listen to that station in Pittsburgh, was the plane of the loop you're using parallel to Pittsburgh, and the normal would be Pittsburgh, I'm assuming, is essentially west of you, so the normal to the loop would be aimed to the north. That's question number one, and I'm glad to hear the select antenna device is still available. Roughly how many dollars is that? Back to you for those two questions, John.
I'm not sure the price. It might be $20 or $30 or something like that. I think there's a company called Sea Crane that sells a lot of, in fact, I think Paul WS2N was talking about that not too long ago. His wind-up radio, I think, was purchased through that company, or I think that company sells that particular radio. They might also have that particular select antenna device. As far as the directional properties, the deal is this. You know, the loop responds to the H field only. So the H field has to wrap around the loop and go through the center of the loop. So a vertically polarized signal will give you a horizontally polarized H field. That horizontally polarized H field has to go through the center of the loop in order to produce any induction and current flow and voltage up on the loop. So the plane of the loop is pointed towards the target. K2RAW and the TechNet from KD2BD.
Yeah, that's opposite of common sense, because a lot of people would orient the loop so that it was broadside to the signal of reception. Now, since Paul WS2N has experimented with some of the stuff, and since he's going to also be giving us a little bit of a space report before we put him to sleep, because he probably has to get up early tomorrow, let's go over to Paul right now before we go back to these particular subjects. WS2N, I wonder if you've seen the new comment that's coming by, that has come by, and what's the latest that NASA is doing? WS2N, K2RAW, and the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I haven't looked for it lately, but no, I haven't seen it yet, Dick, but I'm going to give it a shot. One of these days, we've got probably a week or two, I guess, where we'll be able to be viewed. I don't know, you might know about how long that will be up in the sky for us to see. And as far as the wind-up radio, now I got another one, a portable one, AM, FM. But this is, it's a wind-up type, but it's different than the this bigger one from South Africa that I have. This is primarily, it's really a wind-up flashlight, but it's got a radio in it too, so
That's pretty neat. This one's a little different. It does have an internal battery, and one's from South Africa. That's just that's without any batteries at all. This one has a battery in it. I think a lot of people might have seen them this year. They've been very popular. LED lights. You wind it up for a couple of minutes, and it seems like it's good for I don't know. Without touching the unit, probably a couple of weeks, I guess. I really don't know. Every now and then I'll wind it up. And it does have an AM, FM radio capability, handheld antenna, telescopic antenna that comes out. So that's pretty neat. Not as good as the base unit, the bigger unit, because that one is solar powered, and that'll play forever, for instance, in a backyard or something. Or at a beach or wherever. This one here, you'd have to wind up now and then. They've come a long way with that technology. I don't see a way to change out the battery. I guess they figure that the self-contained battery in it is going to last forever. So they're so inexpensive. I guess if it fails, you throw it away and you buy another one. So much for those things. A lot of fun. That's a good light too. They have either one LED or three LED setting. It works very good. It's still got that bluish glow to it, by the way. And I've read recently that they're looking to change, get the LEDs a little on the brighter white side, more closely to what we normally see when we turn a 100-watt light bulb on. And of course, they're coming down. Eventually, you're going to see them more and more, probably eventually replacing bulbs in your house, I guess. They don't fail. 100,000 hours on LEDs is pretty good. Space Report, one thing I wanted to mention, if the show comes on again, it was shown on PBS last week. I think Channel 13 was on Tuesday, and Channel 21 was on Thursday. But they sometimes repeat these things. This was called Nova Science Now. And they have a number of topics. And one of the topics they covered was something that we spoke quite a bit about here on the net, was the space elevator. And Neil Tyson, he's the guy who runs that Hayden Planetarium, now they got another name for it, in New York, the Rose Center. He was the spokesman for the space elevator. He has a report on it. And they had some good graphics. You know how Nova is. They're pretty good with their graphics. They showed what this thing would look like. It's shooting up this belt to a geosynchronous orbit, what it would eventually look like, and the probability of it being done in the future, and how it would drive the cost down, how our Arthur C. Clarke came up with this many, many decades ago. Originally, he had it in a book, and that's where the initial idea came from. And they have a competition now. They have a group out in, I think it was New Mexico, and they had a competition, $150,000. If you can get your unit to go up a 50-meter ribbon, they had this thing suspended, they had a ribbon with a crane, and all these different groups from colleges and different groups came out with their equipment. One group from Canada, I think. And they attached their climber to this belt. And it's got a bunch of solar panels on the bottom of these things. The original plan, what they would like to do is to have this space elevator go up with laser beams, focus high-powered laser beams on the bottom of the bottom of the unit to supply the power to get the motors to drive this thing up the ribbon. Well, I guess they're not that far along, so they're using different kinds of lights, big spotlights, parabolic lights, whatever they plan on you. Whatever group is doing it, you know, they have their own plan, and they focus their lights the best they can on the bottom of these solar panels, and this thing climbs up the ribbon. And you'll win $150,000 if you can get your average speed to go up this thing 1 meter per second. And they showed them going up. Some guys got caught in the wind came along, and they had troubles. And another guy, he made it all the way up, and he really believes he got, you know, he won the prize. They said, no, not yet. Just under the 1 meter per second rate. So, but the important thing is that they're talking about it. If Nova gets on and discusses these things, that's pretty good. And, you know, any kind of advertisement like that is, you know, bodes well for the future. There'll be more and more people maybe interested in this project. And but I love the graphics. You know, they show the offshore platform, and that's pretty good. So I don't know if you caught that, Dick, or anybody else, but if it comes on again, Nova Science Now, they call it. I wonder if you saw that, Dick. Back to you. K2YRIWWS2M.
Comment question.
Yes, a questioner will pick you up in a second. I definitely saw the program, saw it twice. Very well done. And the project would be able to go forward very soon. NASA has already funded some technical studies of the feasibility of the project. And it's just the carbon nanotube fabrication represents one of the problems that's going to slow it down a little bit. Person who had the question, go right ahead.
Yeah, this is Frank again, K2MLB. I just wondered quickly, Dick, I haven't done much astronomy in recent years, but I still have an old 3.5-inch Questar. I have the full aperture solar filter, and I used to monitor sunspots when, you know, is active on 6, etc., etc. But do you think using the solar filter the comet would be visible as well?
I think the answer is no. And by the way, that 3.5-inch Questar is a beautiful instrument, a classic. That used to be on page number 2 of Sky and Telescope magazine for a zillion years in a row, that advertisement from the Questar company. I also do white light observing. I do it with an 8-inch diameter telescope, but in either case, the level 5, it's not level 5, density 5 filter that we all put in front of our binoculars, telescopes, regardless of size, it is a 100,000-to-1 ratio filter. In other words, you're cutting down the sunlight by 100,000-to-1 to make sure it doesn't burn out your retina and melt the glue that's in your eyepiece of your telescope. The sun is an extremely bright object, and the sun has magnitude, I think it's minus 26.5. The recent bright comet has a magnitude of minus 3, I think it is. So between minus 26.5 and minus 3, there's a huge ratio. So in my opinion, not a chance. Not a chance when you see the comet with that filter installed. Without the filter installed, you're aiming your telescope only 6 inches away from the sun. So you've got to be super careful. If it happens to wave across the sun by mistake, at the instant your eye is at the eyepiece, you're subject to some terrible optical damage. So be very, very careful with this one, Frank. From what I hear, this comet, on a clear day for the next few days, is observable at high noon on a clear day. But you've got to put yourself in the shadow of a building so that you're not directly looking at the sun. You want to look approximately 6 degrees to the left of the sun, to the east of the sun, so to speak, is the way it was explained in a recent memo I read by Joe Rayo. Back to you for any fill on that, Frank. K2MLB, K2IW, the Tech Man.
Yeah, no, that's fine, Dick. You did mention that first, the way of observing it, and I thought the same, but I knew you would know the density of the filter and